This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca in for Ira Flatow. The Cassini spacecraft spent nearly 7 years just getting to Saturn. When it arrived last month, it had to pass through Saturn's rings. The sound of the battering from chunks of ice and dirt was recorded. Sounds a bit like hailstones on a tin roof. But the spacecraft got through okay, and now Cassini is sending back astonishing pictures of Saturn's moons and its distinctive rings. Later this year, Cassini will deploy the Huygens probe to land on the moon Titan for an up-close examination of that unusual celestial body. We're starting our space exploration update with the Cassini-Huygens mission, so if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. My guest for the first part of this tour is Larry Esposito, principal investigator for the Cassini Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph and professor of astronomy at the University of Colorado in the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics. He joins us by phone from Paris, France. Welcome to the show, Dr. Esposito.
I'm glad to be here, Joe.
Well, it's good to have you. And, I guess the first question is, can we get an update on Cassini? Where is it, and what's it doing right now?
Cassini's in orbit around Saturn and will be for an indefinite period. It's now flying away from the planet, and in its first orbit, it'll soon be returning towards Saturn. And while we're in between encounters with the planet, we're taking pictures and movies of Saturn and its moons.
Now, you're the team leader for the Ultraviolet Imaging Spectroscope, or is it UVIS? Is that how you pronounce it?
UVIS is how it's pronounced.
That's how the cognoscenti call it, I guess. What does that instrument do, and what's it useful for?
Our instrument is made up of four telescopes, and we use those telescopes to look at all parts of the Saturn system. Saturn, the planet, its giant moon, Titan, the rings around Saturn, and the smaller moons, and the environment, the whole system that the planet is now residing in.
But why ultraviolet?
The reason we use ultraviolet light is it contains the particular signatures of important atoms and molecules, like water and hydrogen and oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and argon. And from the ultraviolet light, we can identify these compounds in the Saturn system.
Huh. And I gather you've already had some pretty interesting observations of the rings, both. Were they incoming and outgoing, or are you just kind of chronically looking at them?
The opportunity we have was one that will never come again on this mission. It was the closest approach to Saturn's rings just after the rockets fired to put us into orbit. And during that period, we're only about 6,000 miles away from the rings. We use that to make a picture of the rings from our very closest views, and those would be the highest detail pictures that we'll get on this mission, and they're also the highest detail pictures ever made of the rings in the ultraviolet light.
Any surprises?
Well, we didn't know what we were going to find,
Everything's a surprise in that case.
Right. We were hoping to be able to measure the composition and the variation of composition across the rings, and we're fortunate to detect the spectral signature, the fingerprint of water ice, and we found that the ice is variable. There's more of it in the outer part of the rings than in the inner part of the rings.
We're talking with Larry Esposito about the Cassini-Huygens mission. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Have you had any chance to look at any of the moons so far? It seems to me I saw some results from Iapetus not too long ago. I just like to say that, Iapetus. That's such a great word.
You know, we haven't looked at Iapetus, but we did look at the moon Phoebe and the moon Titan.
Uh-huh. And what did you see at Titan?
At Titan, we saw emissions from the upper atmosphere of Titan, characteristic emissions of hydrogen and of nitrogen and carbon.
And was that at all surprising? I mean, it seems to me, I don't know, maybe they weren't the ultraviolet pictures, but some of the, maybe it was the visual spectrum pictures looked a little disconcertingly imprecise. They looked kind of blobby at Titan.
You might imagine that's because the atmosphere of Titan is making those pictures fuzzy, and Titan has a bigger atmosphere than the Earth's. But it turns out that it's actually that the features, the surface of Titan is just a bit fuzzy.
Really? What could be making a fuzzy surface feature? Is there some snow or something like that?
Well, there is snow on Titan, but it's not water snow. Water is frozen solid as a rock, but it could be, like you say, hydrocarbon sludge, things like asphalt that are sort of flowing downhill and have softened the contours of the topography on Titan.
Now, I know it's not your specific part of the mission, but can you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen with Huygens when that descends to Titan? I guess it launches at the end of this year and lands or comes down next year.
Right. We release the Huygens probe from the spacecraft on Christmas Eve, and on January 14th in the new year, it lands on the surface of Titan. It descends through the atmosphere on a parachute, and it's designed to float if it has to, if it lands into a lake or pond on the surface.
But this is not a water lake, I guess.
No, water is frozen solid, right, but exactly. It's possible that methane or ethane could be liquid on the surface with perhaps little bits of acetylene. So those liquids may cover a substantial part of Titan's surface, and if we land in one of those ponds, the probe, the Huygens probe, floats. On descent, it makes measurements of the composition of the atmosphere, Titan's clouds and hazes, takes pictures of the surface, over 600 pictures on descent, which should be a lovely sequence. And then when it reaches the surface, it has a whole set of measurements that measure the characteristics of the surface that it's landing on, including it has a sonar in case it lands in a pond.
Wow. But it doesn't last too long. I mean, it goes down, and then it's only got the battery power to go for a little while. Is that right?
It has battery power for 3 hours, but what happens first is that the orbiter, which is the communications link for the Huygens probe, passes over the horizon. So before its batteries fail, it'll be impossible to communicate any more with the orbiter, the Cassini orbiter, or with the Earth, and that's when the Huygens mission ends.
Okay. We're talking about Cassini, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from Dave in Sebastopol, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I was just wondering if you're going to be able to see the surface of Jupiter at all, or I don't know if Saturn, if Saturn even has a surface, or if it's just all gas, or you're going to be able to see anything down inside Saturn's atmosphere?
Well, Dave, we can't see a surface on Saturn. Saturn has some rocky material, but it's right in the center. It just sort of gets thicker like a milkshake that sat around for a while. So we won't be able to see any surface on Saturn, but we will be able to see the clouds and perhaps some breaks in the clouds in the planet Saturn. It's mostly made up of the gases hydrogen and helium.
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Dave. As you said, it's sort of like a milkshake, but is there a place where it goes from being more or less gaseous to more or less solid, or is that impossible to really say?
Well, it has several transitions from being more or less gaseous to being more or less liquid, and then in the center to being more or less solid. And one of the things we're going to investigate on this mission is exactly where those boundaries are.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to Kyle in Alton, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Hey, my question is that I read somewhere that one of Saturn's moons contained water. And if that was true, would it be able to sustain carbon-based life, maybe plants or something along that line?
Interesting question. Kyle, what about that, Dr. Esposito?
All of Saturn's moons contain water, about 50%. But because of the low temperature, it's about 80 degrees Kelvin, above absolute zero, the same sort of temperature as liquid nitrogen, all the water is frozen solid. And so the water that we've found in the rings and on the moon Phoebe, for example, is ice. It's solid ice. And only if we were able to melt that, either with a meteorite that struck the moon or perhaps underneath the surface, it's hotter underneath, there might be some liquid water miles underneath the surface. And if there is, potentially there could be life there, like life grows under the ice cover in the Antarctic continent. But right at this moment, the water that we've seen is just water ice, and it's too cold for life as we know it.
Is there any thought that that Titan's geologically active enough to be producing heat from its core?
It is producing heat, and the question is, what is its style of activity? We don't know the answer, but when we fly close by Titan on October 26, we're going to be looking for volcanic or geothermal activity, and those would be places, if it's warm enough to melt water, to melt the water ice where liquid water could exist, that we might look for life in the future.
What would be the signature of, would you expect actually to see a place where the surface was melting or something like that? What would you be looking for to see sign of geologic activity?
In the photographs, you would be able to see geologic features like volcanic cones and maybe volcanic flows. Additionally, some of the experiments can measure the heat coming from the surface of Titan, and they would be able to tell that a spot was warm enough to melt water. So it would be sort of like an infrared detector flying over a volcano in Hawaii. You could tell that it was active because it was warm enough to melt rock there.
Okay, interesting. Let's go to Phil in South Dakota. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, yes. Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question actually about one of the other missions, the mission to Mercury that's being launched, like you said, in about a week or so. Just wondering about what some of the goals are there. Because I know Mercury is one of the strange planets closest to the sun, and it's very dense. It has a magnetic field, but it's got a crater.
Hey, Phil, I don't mean to interrupt you, but if you can hold on that question,
okay.
I'll ask it for you, because in a little while later in the program, we're going to be talking to the principal scientist on the MESSENGER mission, and he'll be able to fill us in on Mercury. So let's stick with Saturn for the moment, and why don't we go to Aaron in Boston, Massachusetts. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I had a question just about how fast the spacecraft is actually traveling towards Saturn, and the second part of my question was, if it took 7 years for it to reach the planet, exactly, is it just satellite communication, and how fast does it take for the information to leave Cassini now and reach back to Earth?
So what's the electronic travel time for the speed of light between Saturn and Earth? Do you know the answer to that, Dr. Esposito?
Yes, 84 minutes one way. So if you were to send a message to Cassini right now, you wouldn't get a response for about 3 hours.
Huh.
And the messages, as you say, are all sent by radio, including the pictures are coded up as radio pulses and sent to the Earth and decoded and turned into pictures here. And the speed of the spacecraft is about 10 kilometers per second, 6 miles per second, or that's, about 40,000 miles per hour.
40,000. But the point is that it's captured into Saturn's gravitational field, so it's going to be speeding up and slowing down according to what Saturn orbit tells it to do.
Right. During the orbit, the speed changes, increases as we get closer to Saturn, and decreases as the spacecraft is further away, just like the planets going around the sun. But we are captured into orbit around Saturn now, and we'll be there forever. The spacecraft is going to operate as long as we have battery power and fuel.
Really? And how long is it supposed to operate for, and how long could it operate for?
Well, right now, the first thing that runs out is the money to operate it. We have 4 years of budget, which runs through June 30th, 2008, and we're talking about extending the mission for another 2 years. The project engineers believe it should last about 10 years, and the first thing to run out is probably the attitude control fuel that keeps it oriented so we can point the radio antenna at the Earth and communicate, exchange messages. So I would say it's likely to last 6 to 10 years, and the first thing to fail is the attitude control gas, where it will continue to orbit Saturn, but we won't be able to talk to it because its antenna would not be pointing at the Earth.
Okay, well, I guess what we'll have to do is just stay tuned for more interesting news, and thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
I'd like to thank my guest Larry Esposito, principal investigator for the Cassini Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph and professor of astronomy at the University of Colorado in the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics. Stay with us. We'll continue our tour of the solar system and hear about Mars and Phil's question about Mercury after this break. Don't go away. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking about the solar system and various missions that are out there. In a moment, we'll be going on to Mercury, but first, let's talk about Mars. The twin rovers are outperforming all expectations. Their missions were scheduled to end in April, but they're still going and going and going, traversing the terrain, photographing their environment, and poking at rocks that have names like Pot of Gold and Breadbox. With us now to give us a Mars rover update is Jim Bell, associate professor at Cornell University's Department of Astronomy and principal investigator for the panoramic cameras on Mars. Good to be talking with you, Dr. Jim Bell.
Hello, Joe. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-989-TALK. That's 1-800-989-8255. And, Jim Bell, I gather that, you know, that things are going well. The Spirit is one of the rovers, I guess, is showing a little bit of a sign of age. How's that doing?
Oh, a little bit. It's the afternoon of Sol 197 at the Spirit landing site. And remember, we would have been absolutely thrilled if we could survive 90 sols, and here we are on the verge of 200. So things are going great for Spirit and for Opportunity. Probably the biggest problem that we face is the diminishing amount of power because the sun is getting lower in the sky as the seasons progress later into autumn in the southern hemisphere of Mars. And, of course, you've probably heard about the problem with one of Spirit's wheels drawing too much current. And so that's been tested and ameliorated a bit by just using it less. It's certainly not a debilitating problem. It's just a sort of a, I guess you could say, the rover is kind of walking with a slight limp now.
Huh. But I gather the Spirit, which is having the bit of the wheel problem, has gone up into the Columbia Hills, which when the spacecraft landed at the start of January, the Columbia Hills were this, you know, impossible dream, and now it's there.
Now we're there. I mean, we remember seeing them off in the distance in January and thinking how tantalizing it was to be so close to some interesting hills like that and have very low odds of getting there. And lo and behold, after traversing more than 3 kilometers across the plains of Gusev, we are in those hills and starting to climb up the western spur up those hills. And we expect to, within the next few weeks to a month, to get up to the peak, which is about 100, 150 meters high. They're hills, not mountains,
right.
in one of those hills.
And what's the interest in getting up there?
Well, the interesting thing that we're finding with Spirit is that, you know, we've spent many weeks traveling across these dusty volcanic rock deposits on the floor of Gusev, searching for some evidence of outcrop or water-formed rocks and minerals, and finding very little of that evidence out in the plains. Now, as we're starting to climb the hills, it seems like we've really crossed a geologic boundary. We're in different kinds of materials. We're seeing some tantalizing evidence for real outcrop, you know, what a geologist would call outcrop, rock in place that was formed there. And the compositions are slightly different than what we saw out in the plains. We're seeing some of that hematite material, some more high.
That hematite is the iron-bearing mineral that
That's right.
they think is forms in the presence of water.
That's right, and we certainly, you know, saw that at the Opportunity site in a big way. And so we've crossed a geologic boundary with the rover, and driving up into those hills, we're hopefully uncovering a bit more evidence than we've been able to find before about the water-formed pass of this particular landing site.
Okay, and talk for a minute about Opportunity over in the Endurance crater around the other side of Mars.
Right, Opportunity is also going really well. It's an interesting contrast. While Spirit is going up the hills, Opportunity is going down the crater. We continue to inch our way forward down into Endurance crater, this football stadium-sized hole in the ground. The walls of this crater are showing all kinds of interesting layers, different colors, and potentially different compositions as we march down. So as we're going down, and we've gone about 12 meters or so into the crater, we're drilling small holes with the rock abrasion tool, measuring the composition of each of those layers, kind of like a geologist would do walking down the Grand Canyon or some other cross section where you see different layers and sample each one of them, and you're going back in time and back in time. The interesting thing we're finding is that this high sulfur abundance and chlorine abundance and the kinds of minerals that we saw in Eagle Crater where we landed, we're seeing those also in Endurance, and not just in the upper layers, but as we go deeper and deeper, we see more and more of this evidence for the watery past of the planet. And we haven't found the boundary where we stop seeing that evidence. And so this watery history of this part of the planet may be more extensive than we first thought.
Okay. Jim Bell, it sounds like you'll have to just come back because there's more to say about the rovers before they say goodnight to us.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks very much for staying with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Joe.
Jim Bell is an associate professor at Cornell University's Department of Astronomy and principal investigator for the panoramic cameras on the Mars rovers. And now, as promised, on to Mercury. Mercury is the closest planet to the Sun, extremely dense and hot as a pizza oven. Oddly enough, despite the sizzling heat, scientists suspect there could be water on Mercury, frozen at the bottom of deep craters. NASA's spacecraft Messenger is due to lift off early next month. It will only be the second mission to venture to Mercury, Mariner 10 having whizzed by 30 years ago. Messenger stands for Mercury Surface Space Environment Geochemistry and Ranging, which pretty much describes the purpose of its mission. Messenger is about the size of a large desk, weighs about 1,000 pounds in its stocking feet, and carries 7 scientific instruments. It'll take Messenger nearly 7 years to reach orbit around Mercury. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK to talk about Mercury. And with us now to explain more about the mission is Messenger Principal Investigator Sean Solomon. He's also Director of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Solomon.
Thank you, Joe.
I think we're neighbors. I don't live too far from the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm glad to hear we're neighbors. Thank you.
Anyway, maybe you can tell us a little bit about Messenger and why people want to go back to Mercury. What's the appeal of this planet?
Well, you did a good job introducing the subject. We have not been there for 30 years. It's one of our closest neighbors, and yet we've never seen 55% of the surface by spacecraft, so it remains a big mystery. Some of the questions you raised, like why is Mercury so dense? How did it form to end up with such a different chemistry and such a different history from the other terrestrial planets are some of the issues that are driving us. I think it's important to remember that all of the inner planets in the solar system formed at about the same time by the same set of processes, including our Earth, and yet the outcomes of those processes have been extremely different. And Mercury ended up denser than any other object, but we believe that's because it is more than two-thirds iron metal by mass. It ended up in this bizarre spin orbit resonance, this ratio of 3 days to 2 years that singles it out as an exceptional body. It's got this extreme variation in temperature at the equator. From day to night, it varies by 600 degrees centigrade or 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet, as you mentioned, there's a possibility that water ice is preserved in cold storage in the permanently shadowed floors of impact craters near the north and south poles of the planet. It's got a magnetic field like the Earth does, and that was one of the great surprises of Mariner 10, because we believe that, or believed prior to Mariner 10, that smaller planets should have cooled rapidly and lost the ability to generate magnetic fields by the same process that the Earth did. And we have the evidence from Mars and the Moon that those objects had magnetic fields earlier in their history but lost those fields. So how Mercury, smaller than Mars, should still have a field today is just another one of those questions we're going after with Messenger.
It sounds like quite a bit of stuff to uncover. Let me ask you, I mean, launch is scheduled for August 2nd. Is everything on track? Are you going to make your launch window?
Everything is indeed on track. The spacecraft was mated to the third stage of the launch vehicle more than a week ago. The third stage was lifted to the rest of the launch vehicle, the first and second stage, earlier this week. There's some testing that's been going on this week since the spacecraft was aboard the launch vehicle, but all tests have been successful, and you know that we can't predict the weather and we can't predict quite everything that's going to happen, but we are all set to launch 10 days from today.
And it's a very small launch window, only about 12 seconds as I understand it.
It's 12 seconds per day.
Oh, per day, okay.
But we have 13 days from August 2nd to August 14th. And it's about the same 12-second window each day. It's early in the morning, local time. On the 2nd of August, our window opens at 2:16 a.m. local time. And you're quite right, we have only 12 seconds on that day, and if something causes a hold, then we will simply aim for the next day. And there's a similarly short interval on that day when we can launch.
Well, let's invite our listeners to ask some of their questions about the Messenger mission to Mercury. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's go to Paul in Denver, Colorado. Paul, welcome to our program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what kind of instruments do we have for reading, like, radioactive waves, and what kind of waves we're expecting to see, like UV or maybe even microwaves or whatnot.
Interesting, Paul. Okay. What about that? What kind of waves do you expect to see, Dr. Solomon?
Okay. Well, thank you, Paul, for your question. We are taking seven instruments in total. Several of them are aimed at learning the composition of the surface of Mercury. We will be looking at gamma rays, which are very high energy waves, if you will, that are excited by the impact of cosmic rays on the surface of Mercury and have an energy that is diagnostic of some of the elements there at the surface. We will be looking at X-rays that are excited by the surface materials as a result of X-rays coming off the sun. We'll be looking, of course, at visible wavelengths to look at the geology, both to make images and to look very carefully at the spectrum of reflected light, because that is diagnostic of the kinds of minerals at the surface. And we'll be making use of both UV, ultraviolet, and infrared wavelengths. The ultraviolet is a particularly important range for looking at some of the species in Mercury's very tenuous atmosphere, and the near-infrared also is helpful at diagnosing the minerals at the surface. So we're making as much use of the electromagnetic spectrum as we can to learn as much as we can.
Interesting. Well, let's take another. And Paul, thank you very much for that call. It's nice to hear that the younger crowd is interested in this mission as well. Julie, in Charlotte, North Carolina, welcome to Science Friday. What's your question?
My question is that I know monetary issues are probably the biggest problem with space exploration and looking at the planet. So I was wondering if you had all the money that you ever wanted, is it something like, what would you do with it? And could we go forward faster, or is it something we can't go any faster because of the knowledge that we don't have?
An interesting question, Dr. Solomon.
That's a very broad question, and I'll answer that in a couple of stages. With respect to the Messenger mission to Mercury, I will say that Messenger was selected under a program that NASA has run for the last 10 years, in which they encouraged frequent low-cost missions, and there was an open competition that resulted in our selection, in which NASA did not prescribe the particular scientific target, but there was a limit to how much we could spend, there was a limit to the launch vehicle that we could use, and a limit to the development time. And, of course, we could do more if we had more money.
Mm-hmm.
The total mission cost for Messenger now, from concept to the end of mission operations, is about $426 million. So it's a modest cost. It sounds like a lot of money, but it's a modest cost with respect to some of the missions, Cassini being an example of something that's nearly 10 times bigger.
Dr. Solomon, I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but I have to remind our listeners that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead. You were saying Cassini is, I guess, a $3 billion mission, so Messenger's much smaller by comparison.
It is. And I think it is a testimony to the success of this nation's space program that we do have opportunities for missions of different sizes, and that there is an opportunity to undertake quite ambitious missions that are as expensive as Cassini, and yet there are also opportunities to propose and to have funded more modest missions like MESSENGER that are still tackling entirely new areas. Now, the most general question, Julie, that you asked was, if money were not an object, would there be more things we could do in space exploration? And the answer is certainly yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that there are limits does mean we set priorities and we try to do the things that are most feasible and most important first.
Thanks for that call, Julie. Michael, we have time for one more question from Michael from Northern Virginia. You're on the air.
Hey, great. Thank you for taking my call. Love the show.
Thanks.
Question is, can you kind of explain, talk about, if you will, the 12-second window and what kind of issues surrounding that if you miss that window, launch and miss it before or after, anything having to do with that?
Okay. Thanks for that question, Michael. What about that? I've always wondered why they come up with these really short launch windows and you've got a 7-year flight.
Well, the reason that that MESSENGER has a very limited time each day is that we have a very complicated trajectory. Before we get to orbit insertion at Mercury, our spacecraft has 6 planetary flybys. We fly by the Earth once, Venus twice, and Mercury 3 times. And that means that we depend on a particular set of positions for all of the planets. And those kinds of opportunities are very limited. They don't come up every day, and there's only a very limited time each day when we can launch in the right direction to take use of all of those flybys. It is a marvel of the genius of mission designers that we in fact can do a Mercury orbiter mission because all of these flybys, which contribute to the length of the mission that Joe spoke about earlier, are even possible. So that's what sets the 12-second window each day, and it also limits us to the 13-day window in August.
Okay, well, there's the answer. A complex interplanetary billiard shot. I'm afraid we've run out of time for this segment. Thank Dr. Solomon very much for joining us. Sean Solomon is the director of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C., and principal investigator for the MESSENGER mission. When we come back, it's more space news from McNeil's Nebula. Don't go away.